Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I was out there waiting for Leo to come in. They told me you were already in. So you did two numbers, right?
Right. First
and
number.
The first one was the one we talked about, right? It was so beautiful. It sounded, seemed difficult. It seemed like a difficult piece, wasn't it?
I don't play it too much.
Well, there's a story about this first piece, so yeah, tell us.
Well, the last time Juana gave a lecture, she talked about the snow lion dancing up on mountaintops.
Mm-hmm.
This piece, first piece I played, it's called Kumo Ichishi, which Ichishi is a lion, a snow lion, and Kumo means the clouds. So this piece was snow lion dancing up in the clouds. And it came from a town in Kyushu, the bottom island of Japan, called Hakata, one of the Zen monasteries there. Somewhere during the Edo period, between 1600 and 1860s. And you probably notice a lot of stuff I play is kind of slow and kind of sad and somewhat boring at times. But this is one of the few Buddhist pieces it's more uplifting. It's played mostly in the upper octave because it's up in the clouds. And it has somewhat of a rhythm to it and somewhat of a melody to it, which is unusual for these pieces. So I played that because of the snow lion.
I loved it. It was beautiful. I stood by the window so that I could hear it. It danced. Thank you. Karen, is the light all the way up? How about these lights? The older I get, the more light I need. There we go. Yeah. So some of you have a program and some of you don't. So I'm going to start by reading from the program because it describes what I'm going to talk about and how I'm going to talk about it. Buddhist myths, like all Buddhist teachings, are maps that illuminate the inner journey of transformation. By overlaying a seemingly remote and mystifying teaching onto a mythological story, a kind of interplay ensues where each illuminates the other. When we experience the myth in this way, it becomes an object of our meditation. While giving our attention to the unfolding story, much as we follow our breath in meditation, some deeper part of us opens up. It is into this space that the true voice of the myth speaks, and it never reveals anything that we don't already know. So, I'm going to talk about two familiar myths that most of you have heard a lot, and two abstract and kind of remote teachings. Because for me, the teaching deepens the myth, and the myth clarifies the teaching. So the first teaching is from Katagiri Roshi. Instead of the small familiar self, set yourself out in array in Buddha's world. I'll read that one more time. Instead of the small familiar self, set yourself out in array in Buddha's world. Now, I love the sound of this teaching. It's beautiful. It's kind of exotic. But figuring out what it means and how to really apply it in my daily life, not so easy. And before I can really get a felt sense of a teaching like this, I have to get some flesh and bones around it. I have to bring it down to the ordinary, to the familiar. So the idea came to me of trying to map it onto a flesh and bone story, because stories can be so visceral for us. So here's the teaching one more time. Instead of the small familiar self, set yourself out in array in Buddha's world. And here's the story. In India, at the time of the Buddha, a woman named Kisa married a rich young man, and a son was born to them. The son died when he was a toddler, and Kisa was stricken with grief. Carrying her dead son, she went everywhere asking for medicine to restore her son to life. People thought she had gone mad. Finally, a man of wisdom sent her to the Buddha. Kisa asked Buddha for medicine to restore her dead son to life. Buddha told her that he would need some mustard seeds from a home where there had been no death. Overjoyed at the prospect of having her son restored to life, Kisa ran from house to house begging for some mustard seeds. Now, everyone was willing to help, but she could find not a single home where death had not occurred. As the day dragged on, she realized hers was not the only family that had faced death, and that there were more people dead than living. As soon as she realized this, her attitude toward her dead son changed, and she was no longer attached to the body of her son. So we could simply say that this story is a story about impermanence, and let it go at that. Or we could say that it's just a parable demonstrating Buddha's wisdom and skillful means. We could, but we won't. Instead of the small familiar self, set yourself out in a ray in Buddha's world. Well, with a little bit of effort, I think we can visualize how her awareness expanded as she went from house to house. We can even get a felt sense of how it must have been for her. Her pain and grief were totally impermeable. Not even air seemed to get through the pain she was mired in. For Kisa, nothing else existed. So hers was a universe of pain. But with every house, there was a story about loss, grief, and recovery. So with every house, a little crack in her universe of pain, a little space, and a little openness was created. And little by little, light broke through. So going from house to house, she was setting herself out in array, her awareness expanding to include death as a part of the activity of life. Because an array, by its very nature, is open, and it has the characteristic of light, so emotions pass through it. So that's the first story. Instead of the small, familiar self, set yourself out in array in Buddha's world. So a couple of weeks ago, I came across an article in Shambhala Sun that was written by Reginald Ray. A lot of you guys are familiar with him, but I wasn't. And the name of his article was 3-in-1, A Buddhist Trinity. And in it, he talked about the three grounds, which is a teaching from the Abhidharma. So the first, the ground of existence, gives us a continuous and solid sense of I that is grounded in a practical and conventional world. So that's the first ground. And Reginald Ray says that this ground is affirmed through our activities of body, speech, and mind. This ground, writes Ray, corresponds to the conventional idea of human life, and it's what most people view as the essence of their identity. So that was the first ground. And the second ground is the ground of constant change. So it's the ground of transformation. And in the second ground, according to Ray, here's what he says about it, we find ourselves unable to maintain the identity we have thought of as me. We feel weak and shaky. Our very body and mind seem to be dissolving. And we feel like we're falling, apart. In the midst of this fear, we may feel as if we're dying. We can call this ground death-birth, because whatever dissolution and death we may experience, whether psychological, social, or physical, it is at the very same time a birth into another identity or mode of being. So that is the second ground. And then the third kind of ground is the groundless ground, emptiness. So here we come face to face with our own non-existence. So that was the three grounds that Reginald Ray talked about in this article that I found. And he said that we all embody all three of these grounds all the time. They're present in every moment. Yet we're only usually aware of the ground that underpins this solid sense of I, the first ground. We're usually only aware of the first ground. So I really liked this article, and one of the things that I liked about it is that he mapped the three grounds over another teaching that's really difficult. He mapped the three grounds over the three bodies of Buddha: Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Dharmakaya, which was somewhat helpful because I've never really known what to do with the three bodies of Buddha other than chant it right before a meal. Because the three kayas are really difficult to grasp in a way that we can actually practice with them. But still, for me, mapping one abstract and remote teaching over another slightly less abstract and remote teaching has its limitations. So I wanted to find a story that was familiar and not abstract and map the teachings of the three grounds onto that. Because I was looking for some insight into these three grounds. I was kind of drawn to it, but I didn't really quite know how to process it, how to frame it. I wanted to get a felt sense of it. Because talking about them is one thing, and writing about them is one thing, but feeling them in your bones is another. And I think that any Buddhist teaching, it has to get down into our bones if it's going to be transformative. So this next story, very familiar to most of you guys, a lot of you guys. Some of you know the story of Padachara, like the back of your hand. So as I read it, try to distinguish the three grounds that Reginald Ray wrote about. Or, if you prefer, try to distinguish the three bodies of Buddha. So here's the story, and I'm just going to read it. It's kind of long. As the daughter of a wealthy merchant, Padachara grew up in luxury, attended by many servants. Among them was a boy from a nearby village, and the two of them fell in love. When Padachara was 16, her parents informed her that they had chosen a young man of her own caste for her to marry. But Padachara's heart was already taken, so she and her lover ran away. She lived a hard but simple life, patiently going about her household duties, speaking gently, never bemoaning her frugal life, or wishing for the luxury that she left behind. In time, Padachara became pregnant, and as was the custom, she wanted to return to her family for the birth of her child. "My lord," she said to her husband, "let us go to the house of my family." And her husband nodded and agreed, but every day he made some excuse to delay their departure. At last, Padachara said to herself, "This dear fool will not take me." And she put the house in order and set off alone. But she had waited too long, and her child was born right there on the road. So she turned back and went back home. But a year later, she again became pregnant, and again her husband delayed their departure, forcing Padachara to set out on her own, with one child in her belly and another on her back. And it was the start of the rainy season. So when her husband discovered she was gone, and he took off after her, he caught up with her as a great storm arose, and as her labor pains began. Always happens that way. So lightning flashed all around and great thunderclaps echoed in the sky and rain began to fall in an unending torrent. "My lord," she said to her husband, she always speaks to him like that, "please find us a place that is sheltered from the rain and bring some wood for the fire." So he built a rough shelter. Then, taking his axe, he went to cut some sturdy branches. Meanwhile, Potiphar gave birth on the bare ground while the rain continued to fall. At night, she huddled there. All night, she huddled there, holding her newborn child and her young son close to her and waiting for her husband to return. When daylight came, there was still no sign of him. So the next morning, with both children, she set out to search for him and found him dead, bitten by a poisonous snake. Grief-stricken, Potiphar continued her journey to her home village. Toward midday, they came to a river which was swollen from the storm. Potiphar knew she couldn't carry both children across at the same time. She took her older son and set him down a good distance from the water, telling him to wait for her. Then, with her newborn wrapped close and high on her chest, she waded into the raging river. Reaching the other side, tenderly she set him down on the ground. As she went down to the river, she kept looking back to where her infant lay. Halfway across the stream, as she was crossing to get her other son, she saw a great hawk circling, drawn by the sight of the flesh-colored bundle lying on the ground. Fearful, Potiphar raised both arms in the air and called out, "Sue, Sue, be gone." Again and again she cried out, making a great sound, but the hawk paid no attention. Swooping down, it gathered the infant up in its talons and carried it away. Meanwhile, Potiphar's older son, hearing his mother call out and seeing her raise her hands in the air, thought she was calling to him. Joyfully, he ran down the bank and into the river, where the current swept him away. So Potiphar wept and wailed. Sobbing, she continued her journey towards her home village. And as she went along, she met a man approaching that she recognized. So she inquired about her parents. And she learned that the same storm that turned the river into a torrent had caused several homes to collapse, and her childhood home among them. And both her parents were dead. So at that moment, Potiphar lost her mind. She began to wander, unaware that her clothes were falling from her, babbling and muttering to herself, becoming thinner and thinner. Stumbling and weeping, driven here and there, she came to the outskirts of the city, where she wandered onto the ground of Jatavana, the Buddha's monastery. The crowd saw her and cried out, "Do not let that mad woman come any closer." But Buddha said, "No, do not prevent her. Let her come." And as she stood before the Buddha, he spoke to her. "Sister," he said, "it is time to recover your presence of mind." And hearing the voice of the Buddha, she recovered her mind. So, okay, I'm going to stop there and just talk about it. So if the mapping is going to be helpful, and if the myth is really going to be helpful, we have to remember that this is an inner story. It has to do with transformation. So even the first ground is about our mental constructs. It's not about our outer world. So in other words, no actual person was harmed in the making of this myth, because it's an inner story. So the story tells us that Potiphar was a spiritual seeker. All Buddhist stories are about spiritual seekers. And Potiphar is quite advanced in her spiritual practice. Because the first thing we learn about her is that she doesn't have a lot of attachments to the material world, right? In the very beginning of the story, she abandoned her attachments to the material world, to the luxuries that she'd grown up with, to the riches, just like Siddhartha did, just like the Buddha did. But what happens when we abandon our attachments to the material world in this practice? What happens next? Then we're free to face our inner demons. Again, just like Siddhartha did. So we know that Padachara is ready for this inner journey, because the first part of the story pointed to that. She was ready for this inner journey. The first ground had been tilled and cultivated, aerated, so the sense of I was not so solid. And the Buddha talked about cultivating the ground. He talked about that quite a lot. And this is the ground that he was referring to. So the first death, the death of her husband, marks her penetration of the first ground and her entrance into the second. That's the way I worked with this myth. That's how it kind of spoke to me. So, and the second ground is the ground of impermanence, of death, birth, as Reginald Ray called it. And Padachara was aided by the storm. The universe will always come to us, come to our aid, if we're sincere in our practice. But it doesn't always feel like aid. But we do need help if we're going to let go of our most treasured mental constructs. And in Buddhist mythology, family is often used to represent our most treasured mental constructs. And that makes sense, right? It makes sense to me that Padachara's family represents what the ego treasures most. Our mental constructs that give us the solid sense of I. We don't want to give those things up. The ego doesn't want to let that go. And when we do, it can be painful and disorienting. Because our whole life is constructed around our beliefs and our concepts about who we are and what the world is all about. Now, a common image for a Buddhist practitioner is that of a refugee. But these teachings are not actually suggesting that we should abandon our family. These are psychological grounds. They're having to do with our psyche, not our actual family. So the teaching of death, birth, is that the old has to be destroyed before the new can emerge. That's also what the very helpful goddess, Kali, is all about. She knows that the old has to be destroyed. And we could even think of, as I do, the storm as a manifestation of Kali. She's the goddess of destruction. She's sometimes referred to as the Black Buddha. So for those of you who don't know about Kali, I'll tell you a little bit. She is depicted as being naked, just like Padachara was after she penetrated the ground of ego. She was bare. She was naked. Kali wears a necklace of severed heads because she represents death, because she's the goddess of destruction. And when Kali comes into your life, hold on, because it's usually going to be a rough ride. But she's paving the way for something wonderful. Ray said, Reginald Ray said, whatever dissolution and death we may experience is at the very same time a birth into a new identity, our mode of being. So here again is what he said about the second round. There are times when we find ourselves unable to maintain the identity we have thought of as me. We feel weak and shaky. Our very body and mind seem to be dissolving, and we feel like we're falling apart. In the midst of this fear, we may feel as if we are dying. So transformation is very unfamiliar terrain. How could it be otherwise? The ground underpinning everything we think we know liquefies. And it dissolves. It's kind of like a 9.2 earthquake in our psyche. So Joseph Campbell, the mythologist, talked a lot about this. And for him, charting this ground is what myths are really all about. And this is the ground that's ruled by our inner demons, by greed, hate, and delusion, and all their little minions. So we don't usually like to hang out there. The mythological imagery that depicts Buddha's journey into the second ground describes armies of demons, beautiful temptresses, and fearful beasts. So here's Buddha talking about his experience with the second ground. In the dark of the month with no moon, I entered the most strange and frightening place in the thick of the forest so that I might understand fear and terror. And being resolved to dispel the hold of fear and terror, I remained in whatever posture it arose, sitting, walking, or lying down. I did not change until I had faced that fear and terror in every posture. By facing fear and terror, I became free. So that was Buddha talking about his experience with the second ground. In the dark of the month, with no moon, Padachara entered the most strange and frightening place. In the thick of the forest, so that she might understand impermanence and death. And being resolved to dispel her fear of death, she remained in the moonless thicket and did not re-enter the ordinary world until she had faced death in all its frightful manifestations. By facing death and all manner of impermanence, she became free. So Wei Ning, our sixth ancestor, said, our pure mind is in the depraved one. Well, that could be another of those enigmatic and remote teachings. That doesn't seem very helpful. It's one of those that we look at and say, well, what do we do with that? Until we see it played out in flesh and bones. Because Padachara has clearly entered the depraved mind. And then once we get a grasp of it in this way, in this human way, then we might remember times when we experienced our own depraved mind, filled with anger, bitterness, grief, resentment, fear, hatred. We all have that. And we have to enter into it if we're going to become free of it. And we can't get around it. We just have to go through it. And when we're doing that, we can remember Padachara. Because every moment that Padachara was willing to just be there with her grief, with her despair, and with her depraved mind, her resolve for conscious reclamation was strengthened. And it's the same for us. Every moment that we're just willing to be there with all that stuff inside us that we don't want to see, our resolve for conscious reclamation is strengthened. But we have to be willing to stay there. When Buddha was assailed by Mara, he didn't resist or push Mara away. He stayed right there with all his inner demons until he could see them clearly. And then they just dissolve, because that's what they do. That's what this practice tells us happens. So here's how the story ends. After Padachara returned to her presence of mind at the sound of Buddha's voice, which was her own voice, the voice of her innate Buddha nature, because this is an inner story. So after she returned to her presence of mind, she requested permission to enter the order of nuns. And Buddha took her to the women's sangha and then ordained her himself. And she went on to become a great teacher, devoting herself to the practice of insight. And then the story ends with her enlightenment poem, and here it is. Bathing my feet, I watched the bath water spill down the slope. I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse. Then I took a lamp, went into my cell, checked the bed, and sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed the wick down. As the lamp went out, my mind was freed. So all the mental anguish that tied her to the past just dissolved. And she was completely free of it. So a world of boundless openness appeared. And here's another teaching by Katagiri Roshi. At the pivot of nothingness, the next moment unfolds and a new world appears. Reginald Ray said the third kind of ground is emptiness, or the groundless ground. Here, sometimes abruptly, we come face to face with our own non-existence. So here's another kind of enigmatic teaching that can be seen from the vantage point of Padachara's story. Dogen said, the withered tree is the vivid face of coming spring. I'll read that again. This is Dogen. The withered tree is the vivid face of coming spring. So Padachara was completely withered up. And the voice of the Buddha, her own inner wisdom, her Buddha nature, was the voice of coming spring. So those were two stories that I've been spending a lot of time with the last couple of weeks, and the teachings that just kind of came to me as I was thinking about the stories. Came to me in all sorts of different ways. Came to me through an article. Came to me through little things that I picked up, little research things. And they all just kind of coalesced around these teachings. And for me, that just seems to be how it works. So that's all I have to say about these teachings and these stories. So I'm going to open it up for some discussion. Anybody have any comments or questions? Was that helpful to you? Did those teachings resonate with you? Did the stories resonate with you? Yeah.
In the deepest depravity, there's purity. And if there's, in that depravity, full repentance, it's possible for that person to exceed the spiritual realization of the greatest saints on earth and stand higher than them, no matter what. But most people can't survive that black hole that they go down into and are destroyed. They can't dance with Kali.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that in my prison work for many, many years. I'm working with chemically dependent people, with some of the people that are... Now, I mean, most people are submerged and don't come out of that black hole. I've seen a few that have, and they've transcended into the greatest light and love and service of humanity of any beings I've ever seen, including the highest saints.
Yeah. Joseph Campbell said something about that, too. I'm trying to remember the way he put it was so beautiful. He said that most people drowned in the same water that the mystic swims in. Yeah.
You have to dance with Kali.
Oh, yeah.
Best friend.
Yeah.
Joke with torment brought by the friend, Rumi says. Joke with torment brought by the capital F friend.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, for me in my practice, I've said this before. I don't know too much about Manjushri with all his wisdom. I really don't know much about him. Nor Avalokiteshvara with all her compassion. She's wonderful, but I don't know about her.
Yes, you do.
But I can always depend on Kali. I can always depend on Kali. Thank you. I appreciate that you said that. I appreciate that you said that. I heard that. Dale, you had something? Oh, okay. Yes.
I actually read the story of Kisa just yesterday.
Oh.
And this is my first time here. I realize we all the wind blew here for a reason. Really happy to be here.
Cool. I'm glad you're here too. Thanks. Thanks for that. Hi. Hi, Stephanie.
Well, I really thought the whole concept of how fabulous. Now, I have a little question. So, it will completely make me visible as the non-swimmer, okay? I'm doomed. And actually, maybe that's okay. Maybe there's something to be said not to see necessity and beauty in destruction. I could maybe even say, is there a risk to idolize destruction?
There's a risk to idolize anything. Yeah.
But to see the necessity of destruction, and rather than to say, well, maybe it is not necessary, and I would like to do my part to prevent it.
Mm-hmm.
What about if Patatara, is that her name?
Close enough.
I'm very bad with names.
Right. Yeah, go ahead.
If she was a little bit more Machiavellian and had figured out by the second time of her birth, her pregnancy, that her husband had maybe some good reasons not wanting to get back to the house of the parents, to not ask him, and then would that be completely unbuddhist?
I don't think it would be un-Buddhist. It may not ever make a Buddhist story. But to your question, let me see. Okay, my thought about that is that the three marks of existence are suffering, impermanence, and non-self. So as long as we're alive, we're not going to avoid those things. I mean, we are going to suffer. People are going to die. the teaching here, I think, is that everything arises, it hangs out for a while, and then it dissolves, it dies, everything. Our emotions, our thoughts. So the gem in this story, I think, is that it points out that we can go to those darkest places inside of us. And it feels like terrible destruction, but it's really not. It's just who we are. You know, we don't want to see that. And so as long as we avoid it, we will be avoiding everything in our life. You know, we have to, if we really, I think, if we really want to feel life fully, we have to be willing to go right into the marrow of it. And that's not always going to be pleasant. A lot of times it'll be pleasant, but we can't just have the pleasant. I mean, then our life is just going to be kind of warped and skewed and not really have very much to do with reality at all. But if we're willing to just, we don't go seeking it. We would never go seeking it. Because if you go seeking it, then that's just a whole different problem. That's attachment also. I mean, we don't attach to the suffering that we experience. But we have to know that we can bear it and that and allow ourselves to open up to it so that it can change us. So that we don't drown in it, as Cal was saying.
Yeah, the greatest teaching is adversity, much more than if the things are going very, very smoothly. In a way, it's a prodigal son story in the Christian tradition also. Mm-hmm. Two sons, one is favored, and the other finds himself eating with the pigs and the hogs. And he has a little wake-up, and he goes back to his father. And the father just embraces him so deeply and lovingly. But I think it's an enlightenment story.
Mm-hmm.
And the adversity, I think the easy path, it'll be pleasant in this life, but what's the life? What's your life about?
Shallow. Yeah. I think if we avoid adversity, then we'll also avoid the deeper emotions of really deep joy, really deep happiness that doesn't depend on the exterior world. Because if we are not able to be content when things are not going well, then we only have a happiness that depends on, you know, getting the next new car. You know?
And is it maybe true, could it be true, that we might need practice? Because, let's say, there is a moment, there is nothing to avoid. It is beyond avoiding. And if we've never tried, in small scenarios, to practice that trust that we will not drown, then might that be a crushing moment because we did practice. Practice embracing destruction.
Well, I think we just practice accepting whatever arises in our life and not being destroyed by it. And adversity is going to arise in our life. And also, you know, these myths are pointing to deep truth within our unconscious. I mean, these myths are not creating something that's not already there. These myths are giving us a way to probe our own deep unconscious and our collective unconscious so that we can see who we really are. So I think, you know, we keep wanting to surface when we talk about myths. We keep wanting to surface and talk about them as if they're an outer story. But they are inner stories. They're pointing to stuff that's inside our own subconscious. And that's there, and we need to see it, because it's going to influence every single thing that we do until we do see it and until we're willing to just be with it so that it can dissolve and not control us anymore. Yeah?
What do you mean when you're saying that there is innocence? What's the difference between innocence?
When I say that it's an inner... What is the difference between... She was asking, why do I say it's an inner story, correct?
Yes.
Because it's describing what's going on inside us during transformation. It's describing the chaos that we'll feel, the uncertainty that we'll feel when we give up. Because first, before transformation can happen, we have to be open to transformation. We have to be open to letting go of our old thoughts and ideas that define us. So once we let those go, there's a time in there where we are totally ungrounded. I mean, we're unsupported by anything, and it feels frightening. It feels like death. But if we're willing to just stay there, eventually something arises, and that what arises is what we call our own Buddha nature, the truth of who we truly are, which is the truth of interconnectedness, that we're not this isolated, solitary being that is suffering alone. Is that?
Yeah, so it's sort of like, instead of comparing the ideas in this story to what we already know, it's about comparing the idea in the story to not what we know, but what we know in a different sense than what we've learned.
I would say that it's not about comparing the story at all. It's not about judging it. It's about just listening to it and opening up to it and seeing how it speaks to you. And if you're able to do that in a non-judgmental way, what we call with equanimity, meaning that we just listen to it in an open way without judging it in a favorable way or an unfavorable way. Just kind of listen to it, then it will start to speak to us in our own terms. It will meet us right where we are. And so it'll say something different to you, because it's going to be talking about your own experience, than what it says to me. And when it speaks to you, it won't speak to you in verbal language. It'll speak to you in a way that you feel this movement on the inside, this opening. And you won't even need to try and describe it. You just kind of experience it, because it's that opening that we refer to as spiritual freedom in this practice. And we don't need to analyze it, you know.
I'd just like to say I really appreciate the story of the person who's going through a divorce, losing my health, and being in that suffering and sitting with it. It just, the story really spoke to me. And when you spoke of when she heard Buddha's voice, she was hearing her own. That's been something that's been coming up for me, and where I feel like I'm, you know, dealing with Kali or looking her straight in the face, and then knowing that this is moving me to come closer to hearing my own inner voice. So I really appreciate the story.
No, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah.
I think when I first heard the story, I was immediately just, you know, I felt my chest well up when her children die.
Mm-hmm.
But the more I kind of sit with it, the real tragedy I think that she had to face seemed to be that she always felt like she had home to go to. And maybe there's this assumption that she left home at first and gave up all material attachments, but home was always there. And in a way, I could imagine that it's really easy for us to approach difficulty or kind of venture out and kind of put a toe in the water of a different life or giving up our material attachments when we feel like we always have some place to go to, though. We have a refuge we can go back to. And I think that that last point, the point when she really loses her mind, is when she realized she never had that home to go back to. That, and I think that is really difficult to get into your bones. If you're going to make that, if you're going to penetrate into that second ground, I think it is a kind of home leaving. And maybe when you brought up that on this path we're kind of referred to as refugees, maybe that's what triggered in me that kind of insight into the disillusion of her safe space.
Mm-hmm.
That there was never a safe space. But it does seem like to me she must have always felt like there was one.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to comment on that.
No, I think you did.
There.
Yeah. I think you did a good job by yourself.
Okay.
Yeah. I did sense that final letting go, because she had let go of all the exterior things. But, you know, that solid sense of I, when that goes, that's when the real, I mean, that's when Kali is really here, when that goes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems to me that the cloud story is the fact that she lost her mind.
Yeah.
Somebody who has spent her life really believing that I could figure my way out of every difficulty, every problem, being pretty successful at it. I think for me, in moments where there's been great distress and suffering in my life, that's exactly what needed to happen. I needed to recognize that actually, well, it's not an enemy in some respect. I need to come to the understanding that my mind is my biggest enemy. That actually it was what I was thinking and how I was addressing what was happening in my life that was the biggest problem. In that somehow the transformation took place and started and was still taking place when I had found that suffering actually in my physical body. And of actually being able to sit with sensations and feelings of anger and despair, and literally move through them in my body in a conscious and meditative way. There's something about the embodiment of suffering that is paramount.
I think it's crucial. I think it's crucial that we get out of our head and into our body, because we just spin it around in our head trying to figure it out. And it's in the body where the release actually takes place. I think it's crucial. Thank you. Thank you for that. We have to stop.